Hi, this is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com. Welcome to Speaking of Sex. Come on over to PleasureMechanics.com for the full podcast archive and go to PleasureMechanics.com/free to sign up for a free mini course so we can deliver our best sex advice straight to your inbox. On today's show, I'm thrilled to welcome a special guest, Lisa Wade. Lisa Wade is a sociology professor at Occidental College with degrees in philosophy, human sexuality, and sociology. Her new book, American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus, reveals the often surprising story about what is happening in the bedrooms and frat houses of college campuses, based on in-depth research with students at several colleges ranging from small liberal arts schools to large public universities. In today's episode, we're going to talk about the history of American sex culture, what hookup culture means to students and adults alike, and what you can do to actively change sex culture. Lisa, welcome to Speaking of Sex.
I'm so pleased to be here.
I am so excited because I was a sociology major with a focus on sexuality, so this is like my favorite lens to talk about sex.
Yeah.
For those who aren't familiar with the field, can you orient us a little bit by sharing us how studying sexuality as a sociologist differs from how maybe a psychologist or an anthropologist might approach the subject?
Sure. So a biologist, biology and psychology, I think, seem to your average person like a more proper lens to look at sexuality because obviously it involves bodies and individual motivations and desires. But sexuality is more than just bodies and individual desires. It's also a context in which our desires are made meaningful and in which we enact them. So sociology is kind of interested in looking at what are the external to the individual environments that are shaping our sexual experiences, meaning-making, and decision-making. So that might be what are the morals around sexuality that we learn and sometimes internalize or otherwise have to live with? What are the opportunities that we get as a sexual person? Who is around us and how close are they? And what kind of connections can we make that may become sexual? What is the structure of our society? And then also, like, for example, who is valued? What bodies are valued in our society? And how does that affect who we find erotic to begin with? So sociology is looking at a lot of things that are impacting our sexual thinking and feelings that are not purely individual.
Yeah, when I get email from people, so often what they want to hear is that they're not alone, that they're normal, and to give their issues kind of this social context. And usually it's this aha moment of, oh, it's not just me struggling in this void. It's influenced by our culture and mm-hmm. by everything around us. And that often makes people feel a lot better about what they're going through.
Oh, sociology is so empowering because it teaches us that we don't have perfect control of our lives, which is terrifying, but it's also in many ways very liberating. And once we can see that our lives are being shaped by forces outside of us, then we can actually act to think critically about and sometimes change those forces.
And I thought the book was interesting because it's easy to imagine that different college campuses have different cultures and different sex cultures. And that perhaps makes it kind of interesting to study sexuality within the boundaries of a college campus. But so much of what we learned through the book, I think, is affecting all of us, even as adults. So let's dive into hookup culture and first define our terms. So hooking up can mean a lot of different things to different people. What's your working definition of hookup culture?
So hooking up is, we could say it's a behavior. It's a script and it's a culture. The behavior is when two people have some ambiguously defined sexual activity that is not intended to have any romantic or even future sexual consequences. So it's a one-time thing that is not supposed to be meaningful or emotional. The script is the set of rules for how one initiates and then proceeds with a hookup. So there's a particular way in which we learn how to initiate these things. And then the culture is an environment in which, one, hooking up is seen as the primary or only way students can engage or anyone can engage sexually. A set of rules for engagement that facilitate hookups, that push that particular script. And then also an institutionalization, so a way in which hooking up is made part of the rhythm of and the architecture of the space you're living in. So the culture is sort of at three levels. It's these ideas about hooking up, the script for hooking up, and then the institutionalization of hooking up as well. So there's always been hooking up on college campuses. There has been hooking up since human beings existed. But the existence of a hookup culture is a new thing. The idea that students should be hooking up and all of the ways in which hooking up is facilitated, that is new.
All right. So I'm going to put you on the spot and ask for a lightning speed rendition of the past, say, 100 years of sex culture. And how did we get here? I love what you did in the book of kind of showing the trajectory of how sex culture has changed in the past 100 or so years and how we've arrived at this place.
Okay, I'll do my best.
Okay.
Most of American history after colonization from Europe, people lived in rural communities or on farms, very, very spread out across the United States. And so it would be difficult to have a hookup culture in that environment because there just weren't enough people in the same place to have lots of sexual partners. This changes in the 1920s. In fact, 1920 is the first year that more than 50% of Americans lived in cities. Mm. Cities happen because of industrialization. Industrialization brings all the work together into these massive factories and factory-like environments. And so suddenly we have these urban environments. And once you have a dense population of people, you can have things like bars and clubs and amusement parks and movie theaters and the kinds of things we associate with nightlife today. Once we have nightlife, courtship changes. So back when we're all living on the farms, what would typically happen is a young man interested in a young woman would be invited by her mother or her aunt or some other female adult to come visit at her home. And they would sit in the parlor or on the porch and they would have tea and they would be heavily chaperoned and they would get to know each other in that way. But once we move to the city, courtship leaves the home and goes into the streets. And in the streets, whereas women had control of courtship back in the home, in the streets, men got control of courtship. And so primarily because men could afford it, because it was now expensive to court, and women didn't have any wage protections. So if a woman wanted to participate in the great, exciting new nightlife, she had to get a man to sponsor her, or at the time it was called treating. And this is the origin of the idea that men should pay for dates. Mm. So in that environment, now men have control. So men get to pick which women they want to spend their money on. And this is the decade, the 1920s, 1930, where we see the rise, the real rise of reducing diets meant to enable women to lose weight, and sales of cosmetics octuple in that decade. So there's this incredible shift in power where suddenly women are trying to please men. And one of the ways that they please men is by being also sexually flirtatious and possibly sexually available. So you might call the 1920s, young people there, like hookup culture's great grandparents. So things change with the Great Depression and with the really bizarre decade of the 1950s where everything gets super conservative. And of course we have the HIV epidemic, but in general, this idea that it should be fun and exciting. Sexuality is fun and exciting continues to ramp up over the decades. It's absolutely, pushed forward by the movements of the 1970s, so the civil rights movement, the women's movement, sexual revolution, and gay liberation. And all the while, our belief in individualism is rising, so Americans are becoming more and more self-interested, putting themselves and their own desires and interests first. And we're becoming increasingly androcentric. And in sociology, that word means that we value masculinity over femininity. It's a very specific kind of sexism. It's not really about bodies, but about the embracing of masculine ideas and norms and personality traits and careers and leisure pursuits over-feminine ones. Men and women are becoming increasingly androcentric over these decades as well. And so if you think about the ways in which we tend to gender sexuality, so that there's a feminine way of being sexual and a masculine way of being sexual, then hookup culture looks a lot like a whole bunch of people all trying to enact a stereotypical male sexuality. And that's part of how we got here.
And so you argue that the hookup culture that we see on college campuses and with hookup apps like Tinder, it's not really the sex that's problematic. It's the culture around it. And this disparity between relationships that are caring and reciprocal, maybe those feminine values you were talking about, and the hookups that are supposed to be emotionless and distant and non-reciprocal when it comes to orgasmic pleasure. Can you talk a little bit more about that, that it's not really the sex? Because we often focus on the sex and the physical consequences, you know, the STIs and the pregnancy. But what's really harmful about this culture?
Yeah, I was clued into this because we have really good quantitative data about what students are doing sexually on campus, and they're not actually hooking up very much. Right. They don't have any more sexual partners if you measure by intercourse than their parents did at their age. Mm. The average number of hookups for a graduating senior is 8. So that's one hookup per semester. Many of those are happening right at the beginning of freshman year. So there's this kind of bump in sexual activity that peters out after that. Less than half of those include intercourse, and half of them are with someone the person's hooked up with before. There simply isn't that much sexual activity going on college campuses. And that suggested to me that if students were unhappy with sex on campus, it couldn't be because of the sex they were having. And so that's why I turned to look at the culture. And one of the things the culture tells students is that we have, on the one hand, romantic, committed, emotional relationships that are monogamous, and that is a space where love and care occurs. And most students want that for themselves at some point. But hooking up is contrasted to that in every way. So if they're not monogamous, they're not committed, but they're also supposed to be not emotional and void of care and concern and love. And so what that does is it opens up the possibility for hookups that are not just sort of neutral, but actually quite uncaring and unkind and callous or cruel. And there's the rules of hookup culture tend to sort of twist students' arms into behaving in ways that are unkind. And that's not, it turns out that's not very pleasant for most people.
And is this men and women alike are kind of feeling shafted by this culture?
Yeah. I mean, what I found, so men on college campuses are actually slightly more likely than women to say that they wish they could be in a committed relationship. Yeah. In one study, 75% of men and 70% of women said they would like to do that. In another, 70% of men and 67% of women said that they wish there were more opportunities for finding a romantic partner. So men are human beings, and they also want connection and love, and there's nothing that shouldn't be surprising to us. But hookup culture also tends to be less painful for men. And so whereas a lot of the women that I talked to were disgusted or outraged or traumatized by hookup culture, a lot of the men I talked to were simply disappointed or frustrated.
Okay, so how close, we are hearing a lot about rape culture and rape culture in society at large, but also on campuses. How closely connected is hookup culture with rape culture, and how do the two support one another?
They're deeply connected. Students are being told that sex happens on this continuum, right? And on one end is this beautiful, loving sex that is full of emotion and makes, I mean, it's literally, we call it making love, right? It is the one thing we believe in our society that can actually make love out of thin air. So that's the kind of sex that they think happens in relationships, ideally. And then on the other end of this spectrum is sex that is the opposite of that. It is emotionless. It is meaningless. There is no beauty and no connection. And then right next to that, further along this spectrum, is sexual assault. So it's sex that's actually cruel and exploitative and designed to hurt other people. And so we are asking students to put their sexual experiences right up against the line between careless, callous, or the lines between careless, callous, and criminal. And that is really dangerous. It's very dangerous because it's very easy to fall over that line, especially when we're young and we don't know what we're doing and maybe we're drinking a lot. Any of us would be vulnerable, but in particular, young people who are new to sexuality, remember 50% of college students are virgins when they arrive on campus. And then we're asking them to just walk this incredibly fine line. It's very dangerous. And it makes it so that students who are predators, who are deliberately exploiting their peers, can do so in ways that are invisible, because what they're doing is so close to what everyone thinks they're supposed to be doing. And then it also creates criminal behavior in people who would otherwise never choose that. So people who accidentally fall over, it becomes a catalyst for criminal activity, hookup culture does.
Yeah, I've talked to so many people who either experienced assault as the victim or the perpetrator who didn't even realize it was happening as it was happening, mm-hmm. mostly because of alcohol and intoxicants. And it's almost the sense that we don't know what the rules of good, consensual, healthy sexuality are because of this culture that's permeated, that's go to the party, get drunk, grind up against someone, and then kind of get as far as you can.
And I want to take a little bit closer look at the role of alcohol. Yes, they're drinking, and when we're drunk, we have bad judgment, right? And we make mistakes. But if you're drunk and watching a movie, or if you're drunk and playing a board game, or if you're being drunk doesn't become a catalyst for sexual assault. It's only a catalyst for sexual assault once we've decided that the space they should occupy as a drunk person is right next to sexual assault. Mm. So, I think it's important to remember that part of the problem is that we're specifically asking students to not care about one another. And once we're saying don't care about that other person, then don't care about their pleasure, don't care about their consent, don't care about their personhood. It becomes a really dangerous place to be drunk, if that makes sense.
And what is the attitude about caring about? So if you reach out via text or email the day after a hookup, what is the perception there?
So the idea is that wanting connection or having feelings is pathetically feminine. And both men and women are told that that's a bad thing to be. And so both men and women tend to try to avoid seeming to be emotional or desiring of one another in any way that's not lust. This is the legacy of this growing androcentrism, this stigmatizing of femininity. So the worst thing you can get called on college campuses today, it isn't slut and it isn't even prude, which is actually more consistent with hookup culture. It's desperate. Being desperate or clingy or needy, wanting someone, feeling for someone is seen as just weak and embarrassing. And so students try to, of course, students are feeling all kinds of things, and they're feeling, they have positive feelings for each other all the time, but they often try to hide them, because to do otherwise is to kind of lose in this game where you have to care less about the person than they care about you in order to not be seen as pathetic.
And do you see this translating into dating culture amongst young adults?
Yes. So remembering that hooking up is a behavior and a script and a culture. So the hookup script is very alive in young adult culture more generally, even young people who aren't living in hookup cultures. And I think it's filtering up as it's gaining power at all ages in America, particularly as things like Tinder are filtering, are ways in which we're carrying the script out into the wider world, out of the culture and into the wider world in the palm of our hand. So I think that my guess is, and I'm not studying non-college students, my guess is that the script has gained more power over the last couple decades, even outside of the culture. And when I did some follow-up interviews with students who had graduated, and they often felt that was true, that the dating script, which presumes romantic interest, and the hookup culture script, which presumes no romantic interest, were often operating side by side, and they never really knew which one their potential partner was using or when the script might flip from one to the other. So there was a lot of, one of my students said that she felt like there was no ground beneath her feet.
Hmm. Yeah, I think I've seen this a lot of my peers, if they emerge out of college and then have these early years, usually in a city where they're focusing on their career, having casual sex, then all of a sudden they're ready to start a family and looking around them and kind of haven't had a lot of long-term relationships and don't really even know what they want. But they've kind of taken college behavior out into the world, and then all of a sudden it's not working for them anymore. What have you seen in terms of students creating alternative sexual cultures? Are there any examples of students actively working to create healthier sex culture on campus?
Yeah, there are. So one of the more popular things for young people on campuses to do is start clubs that are aimed at enhancing the positive aspects of sexuality. So campuses are usually involved in trying to reduce the harm of sexuality, mm-hmm. Through programs to promote safer sex and to reduce the rate of sexual assault. And a lot of students come to campus and say, "Well, wow, that's really sex negative. You know, really negative focus on sexuality." So they start these sex positive groups. Many of those I have noticed tend to be, in my estimation, a bit advanced. Remember that these are people who generally have not a lot of sexual experience, if any, and a lot of these groups tend to emphasize things like how to have multiple orgasms and how to play with sex toys and, you know, BDSM training and stuff like that. And so these are really neat initiatives on college campuses, but I think that they tend to be a bit sophisticated for your average student. What I'd like to see is more emphasis on just the basics of how to interact with another person sexually. I think we're failing to help young people understand how to be respectful and sexual at the same time, how to be kind and sexual at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to see more of that. In general, it's difficult because college students are this rotating population, and the students that arrive as freshmen spend a lot of time just getting oriented to the culture that exists. And by the time they get around to wanting to change it, it often feels like they're already graduating out of it. Mm. So I really think it's the institutions that need to actively get involved in helping students feel empowered to change their cultures the minute they arrive on campus.
How can we do that?
Well, I think that it's actually not that hard. Mm. Cultures are interesting because they exist only if we allow them to exist. No individual can change the culture they live in. And a third of the students I studied wanted nothing to do with hookup culture, but they still lived in hookup culture. There was little they as individuals could do about that. So cultures have this sort of power and inertia because they're immune to individual will. But as soon as a collective group decides to reject a culture, then it's gone because it only exists insofar as we allow it. It only exists insofar as we allow it to colonize our minds, our collective minds, and be a part of our institutions. So cultures are actually really easy to change if we collectively put in the effort. And because colleges are these institutions that are a very bounded group of collected people, it's actually, if everybody gets on board, not that difficult to change it. So what we need to do is we need to be making sure that students that are coming in as first-year students are given the whole array of options for sexuality, the whole array of safe options that we can. And so we need to interrupt the dominance of hooking up as the only or best or only seen as a cool or interesting way to be sexual. And we need to also interrupt the dominance of the students on campus who enjoy hookup culture the most. So it turns out that the students that like hooking up the most, advocate for it the strongest, are the students on campus with the most power. And those students are the same the same as the people in America that have the most power. They tend to be white, heterosexual, class privileged, able-bodied, conventionally attractive men. And hookup culture's best petri dishes, where it's nurtured and grown, and particularly where its most toxic features are nurtured and grown, are the places where those people dominate, like certain athletic teams and fraternities. So colleges also need to take the sociosexual power from those people. One of the interesting parts of the history of the emergence of hookup culture is that once we raised the drinking age from 18 to 21, the only place left to go drink on many college campuses was the frat house. Because you couldn't do it in the dorms anymore, couldn't go to bars and clubs without a fake ID, sororities weren't allowed to throw parties with alcohol, so fraternity men sort of were literally handed the social power on college campuses when it came to student social lives. And those men tend to like hookup culture proportionally more than any other student on campus, and so that's the kind of parties and the kind of culture they promote, and because they have so much power, they can do that. So colleges need to be interrupting that power as well.
Yeah, and in the book, you gave some amazing and disturbing examples of some of the party themes that frats use to sexualize their parties. Is there any initiative for sororities to serve alcohol?
This is a really interesting idea that I think is a non-starter. And the reason is because sororities aren't dry because of some old-fashioned rule about women and alcohol. Mm-hmm. Although that may have been why it was originally. The reason sororities are dry today is because to the insurance rates that would be required, they'd have to pay to actually start throwing parties with alcohol, are astronomical. In the 1980s, the insurance actuaries rated fraternities as the sixth or seventh most dangerous organization to insure after toxic waste removal companies. So companies that are actually transporting toxic waste were slightly more of a risk than fraternities. Fraternities emerged as these incredibly dangerous places, not just because of sexual assault, which is happening, but because of binge drinking and alcohol poisoning and the kinds of fighting and accidents that happen. And so fraternities, in order to keep doing what they were doing, they had to turn around and no one would insure them anymore. So they variously figured out what to do by buying insurance companies and then insuring themselves or creating insurance collectives. So right now, fraternities insure themselves, and the men in fraternities are paying a lot of money for the privilege of being dangerous places. And sororities are not going to do it because the women, I believe, are not going to turn around and say, sure, charge us several hundred dollars more a month for this privilege when we can just go across the street.
Wow. Okay, so that's an amazing example of how an institution can dictate norms on campuses. And a lot of our listeners want to understand like how they as individuals can change sex culture. And you just said that no individual can do it alone, but collectively we can have an enormous impact. And so for adults listening to this who look around and see how messed up our sex culture and have a vision for a healthier sex culture, what are a few simple acts that they can put into place in their life to actively change the sex culture we all live in?
Well, you know, collectivities are nothing more than just a whole bunch of individuals, right? Uh-huh. So individuals can't change it by themselves, but they certainly can look around and link arms with the people around them and start change that way. And so the first thing that I think we need to be doing is being brave enough to be open and honest with the people around us about what we want uh-huh. and what we do and don't like. And this applies to college students and the rest of us as well. Particularly when it comes to sexuality and romance, there's this fear of telling the truth because we don't want to be rejected. And that's a pretty powerful desire. And so we often kind of try to figure out what's going on without actually playing our hand. And I think that that's really too bad because it means that no one understands what other people are feeling, really. And we never really get what we want or our chances of getting what we want are much, much less. You know, the vast majority of students on campus think that everyone else just wants to hook up when, in fact, the opposite is true. Mm. Most students are deeply unhappy and unsatisfied in hookup culture and would like a greater connection. And so the majority of students who would like to do that, they're all, we call it pluralistic ignorance when a large proportion of a population misunderstands its own reality. That can only, that can only persist when everyone's keeping quiet. So I think, the first thing we all need to be doing is just being more open and transparent about what we want and not allowing, the fear of being seen as somehow weak or pathetic or sad, to keep us from pursuing what we know would make us happy. And I think on college campuses, for example, if one student says to one other student, you know what, I don't like this, I would prefer something different. And that other student says, you know what, me too. And those two brave souls, you know, tell two other brave souls, and those four brave souls tell eight other brave souls, then the people that are a little less brave suddenly have a space to go. And the people that are even less brave than them suddenly have a place to go. And by just talking, you can elbow out hookup culture and make space for other kinds of ways of engaging sexually. Now, whether that's polyamory or traditional dating relationships or queerer spaces or what have you, the less room that hookup culture can take up at this point, the better, because right now it's got everything, right? And then the same would be true in our daily lives, you know, being straight and open and honest about what we want and being willing to lose potential partners because they don't want what we want, even though that might seem scary or like rejection, I think is really important.
I love it. And, you know, we always say that the shame and silence around sexuality is part of how sexual oppression is maintained. And being brave enough to talk about sex openly is really the first step.
Yeah, but I think this is being brave enough to talk about feelings, right? Mm. Right? I mean, so students know that they're supposed to say, like, you know, I like it when you do X to me, right? You know, they're much less afraid of helping someone actually know what they want sexually. Talking about sex is actually something we do a lot, but talking about our feelings, that is something we are not doing as much as we need to be doing.
Mm. The new vulnerability.
Yeah.
Well, I loved your book. I read it twice in a week. Charlotte said, didn't you finish that book already? I was like, yeah, I went back to the beginning.
Oh, thank you so much.
So important, I think, not only for parents who might have college-age students, but for anyone who really wants to understand the sexual climate we're living in today.
Yeah.
So it's called American Hookup, The New Culture of Sex on Campus. Grab your copy. And folks listening to this, get in touch with me and let me know what you think and what parts stood out for you. And Lisa, where can people find you online?
Oh, if they Google my name, it's hard to miss me. My website is lisa-wade.com.
And can you tell us briefly about the blog you run, which I have been loving for many years now?
Sure. It's called Sociological Images. And it's several times a week, we'll put up a short and easily digestible sociological analysis of something going on in the world. Usually some new data that's come out or an ad that could use some analysis, something like that. So we try to offer sociologically inspired, quick analyses of daily life.
Awesome. And I really recommend it for people who want to get more of a perspective of how sociology can be a lens into understanding our world. And as you said, be really empowering for feeling like, A, I'm not in total control of my life, and that's okay, but I can also try to steer culture towards a healthier place for us all. So check that out. Thank you, Lisa, for your time. And thank you for this book. It's a really meaningful one.
Thank you so much.
Okay. This is Chris from PleasureMechanics.com, wishing you a lifetime of pleasure.